Chapter 31. The fiery bantam marched through the executive corridors of Numa's headquarters as if he owned the building, which, in fact, he essentially did. Admiral James Sandecker was a revered figure throughout the halls, offices, and laboratories of Numa. The legacy of his founding the agency with a handful of scientists and engineers several decades before. Though diminutive in size, his blazing blue eyes and bright red hair with matching goatee simply advertised the burning intensity with which he operated 24 hours a day. "Hello, Darla, you're looking stunning today," he said graciously to the 40-something secretary typing on a computer. "Is Rudy in the executive conference room?" "Good to see you again, Admiral," the woman beamed as her eyes roved to a pair of Secret Service agents struggling to keep up with the fast-moving chief. "Yes, Mr. Gunn is waiting for you inside. Please go right in." Though still regarded as the Admiral by his Numa comrades, the rest of the world knew him as Vice President Sandecker. Despite a lifelong aversion to the subversive world of Washington politics, Sandecker was persuaded by President Ward to fill the shoes of the vice presidency when the elected Veep unexpectedly died in office. Sandecker knew the president to be a man of honor and integrity who would not force his second-in-command to remain a wallflower. The fiery admiral immediately broke the mold of past vice presidents. Far from being a figurehead and emissary for state funerals, Sandecker held a strong position in the administration. He vigorously spearheaded defense and security reforms, increased the funding and focus of government-sponsored scientific research, and led the point for environmental conservancy initiatives and all matters relating to the seas. At his bullying, the administration successfully strong-armed a worldwide ban on whaling by all industrialized nations, as well as implementing a host of tough penalties and sanctions on ocean polluters. Sandecker burst through the door to the conference room, immediately hushing the group of Numa officials deliberating the loss of the Sea Rover. "Thanks for coming over, Admiral," Gunn said, jumping up and showing his boss to the head of the table. "What's the latest information?" Sandecker asked, dispensing with the usual round-the-table pleasantries. "We've confirmed that the Sea Rover has in fact been sunk after being attacked in the East China Sea by a small armed force that infiltrated the vessel. Miraculously, the crew escaped from a locked storage hold minutes before the ship went under. They were able to make it into the lifeboats, where they were later spotted by an Air Force search and rescue plane. A nearby freighter was alerted, and they have since been picked up. The freighter and crew are en route to Nagasaki as we speak. All but two of the crew have been accounted for." "She was boarded by force?" "A stealth commando team of unidentified nationality got aboard her at night and took over the ship without a struggle."
"That's Bob Morgan's ship, isn't it?"
"Yes.
The old goat apparently put up a fight and took a gunshot wound to the leg during the struggle. I spoke with Ryan, his exec, who told me that he's expected to pull through in good shape. According to Ryan, the boarders claimed to be with the Japanese Red Army. They made their escape in a cable-laying ship bearing the Japanese flag."
"Odd choice of attack ship," Sandecker mused. "I take it they absconded with the biological bombs that had been recovered from the I-411?
"Ryan confirmed as much. They had nearly completed the recovery operation at the time of the attack. The Starfish was missing when the crew escaped from the hold, and Ryan believes it was hoisted onto the attack ship, perhaps with the submersible's missing pilots. I'll call the State Department and request an immediate dragnet from the Japanese naval resources." Sandecker pulled an enormous Dominican Republic cigar out of his breast pocket and lit the green stogie, sending a thick plume of smoke towards the ceiling.
"Shouldn't be too difficult to peg a cable ship when she slips into port."
"I've alerted Homeland Security, who was working along those same lines. They don't seem to believe the Japanese Red Army has the skill or technology to create a domestic threat with the weapons, but are now looking at possible ties to Al-Qaeda and a few other terrorist organizations."
"I wouldn't bet against it," Sandecker replied dryly as he rolled the cigar between his thumb and forefinger. "I'll brief the president this afternoon. Someone is going to damn well pay for destroying an American government vessel," he snarled, his eyes ablaze. The inhabitants of the conference room nodded in collective agreement. Though a large organization, there was a close-knit sense of family within the agency, and an act of terror against fellow colleagues halfway around the world was still felt strongly by those at home.
We share your sentiments, Admiral, Gunn replied quietly. By the way, the two crewmen that are missing? Sandecker asked. Gunn swallowed hard. Summer and Dirk Pitt. Presumed abducted with the starfish. Sandecker stiffened in shock. Good Lord, not them. Does their father know? Yes. He's in the Philippines with Al Giardino trying to contain an underwater environmental hazard. I spoke with him by satellite phone, and he understands that we are doing everything we can right now. Sandecker leaned back in his leather chair and gazed at the cloud of blue cigar smoke drifting above his head. God have mercy on the fool that would harm that man's offspring, he thought. 7,000 miles away, the blue catamaran ripped across the west coastal waters of Korea like a top fuel dragster running the traps. Summer and Dirk were nudged and rocked in their luxury confinement as the speedy yacht tore through the swells at almost 40 knots. A pair of Korean fishermen in a rickety sampan cursed vehemently as the cat stormed perilously close by, the powerful boat's wake washing waves over the sides of the tiny fishing boat. After 2 hours of hard running, the catamaran turned inland and slowed its speed as it threaded its way through the sprinkling of small islands that dotted the mouth of the Han River. The pilot maneuvered the boat upriver another hour until spotting the semi-hidden channel that curled into Kang's Kyodongdo Island lair. Passing through the inlet that he knew was monitored by hidden video cameras, the pilot guided the catamaran across the cove to the floating dock at the base of the sheer walled compound. Inching to a stop, the blue catamaran was tied up astern of Kang's gleaming white Benetti yacht. Dirk and Summer remained locked in their cabin as Tongju strode off the craft and rode the elevator up the cliff to Kang's private enclave. Kang sat in his cherry-wood-paneled executive office with Kwan, studying the financial statements of a radio component manufacturer that he intended to acquire via hostile takeover. He looked up slowly when Tongju entered and bowed. Captain Lee of the Baekje has sent word that your mission was a success, Kang stated through tight lips, offering no hint of satisfaction. Tongju nodded slightly. We acquired the ordnance after it was salvaged by the American vessel. 10 of the devices were still intact and have been determined to be usable, he continued, neglecting to mention that Dirk had sabotaged the other two canisters. More than a sufficient quantity to proceed with the operation, Kang replied. The weapons scientists aboard the Baekje were most pleased. The devices were immediately transferred to the biological research laboratory upon our arrival at Incheon. The lab chief assured me that the necessary refinement and containment will be complete within 48 hours. At which time I trust the Baekje's reconfiguration will be complete. Tongju nodded in reply. She will be ready to set sail on time. Schedule is critical, Kang continued. The mission must be achieved ahead of the National Assembly referendum vote. As long as there is no delay with the ordnance, we will be ready, Tongju assured him. The shipyard workers had already made impressive progress by the time we departed the dock facility. We cannot tolerate another miscalculation, Kang said coldly. Tongju squinted slightly, unsure of his boss's meaning. Ignoring the comment, he continued speaking. I have brought two of the captives from the American vessel with me, the pilots who operated their submersible. One of them is the man responsible for the death of our two agents in America. I thought perhaps you might wish to entertain him personally, he said, placing a sinister emphasis on the word entertain. Ah, yes. The two missing crew members from the Numa ship. Missing crew members? Kwan stepped forward and thrust a news story gleaned from the internet into Tongju's hands. It is all over the news, Kwan said. Research vessel sunk in East China Sea. All but two saved, he quoted from a headline in Chosun Ilbo, Korea's largest newspaper. Tongju's face went pale, but he didn't move a muscle. That is impossible. We sank the vessel with the crew sealed in a storage hold. They could not have all escaped. Escape they did, Kang said. A passing freighter picked up the crew and took them to Japan. Did you not watch the ship go under? Tong Ju shook his head. We were anxious to return with the salvaged material at the earliest possible moment, he said quietly. It is being reported that the ship suffered an accidental fire on board. Apparently the Americans are afraid of publicizing yet another terrorist incident, Quan said. As well as revealing the true nature of their presence in the East China Sea, Kang added. Perhaps the lack of media reporting will temper their investigation into the incident. I am confident that we maintained our false identity. My assault team was of mixed ethnicity, and only English or Japanese was spoken while on the American ship, Tong Ju replied. Perhaps your failure to dispose of the crew was not a bad thing, Kang stated with a slight glare. It will further embarrass the Japanese and keep the American intelligence effort focused on Japan. They will, of course, be searching for the Baekje. The sooner she can be put back to sea, the better. I will provide a continuous update from the shipyard, Tong Ju replied. And the two Americans? Kang perused a leather-bound schedule book. I am traveling to Seoul for an engagement with the Minister of Unification this evening and shall return tomorrow. Keep them alive until then. I shall give them a last supper, Tong Ju replied without humor. Kang ignored the comment and stuck his nose back into a stack of financial documents. Taking the clue, the assassin turned and departed Kang's office without making a sound.